This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Welcome back to the second part of the Financial Sense News Hour and the part of the program we call the Big Picture, where we attempt to unravel and decipher all of the little information dots you see floating out there. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here.
The job market remains strong, the economy continues to expand, and inflation appears to be moving toward the FOMC's 2% longer run goal. As you already know, we decided today to raise the target rate for the federal funds rate by 0.25 percentage point, bringing it to 1.5 to 1.75%. This decision marks another step in the ongoing process of gradually scaling back monetary policy accommodation, a process that has been underway for several years now.
Voice of Fed Chairman Jeremy Powell this week at their press conference, where they announced that the Fed would be raising the federal funds rate to 1.75%. Now, the move was widely expected. It was not a surprise. And more importantly, they indicated that more hikes are expected as the Fed continues its path of gradual rate hikes. And so expectations now are that there will be 3 hikes for this year. The Fed meeting was considered to be dovish and not as hawkish as the markets had feared about the possibility of raising interest rates 4 times this year.
But there was a hawkish element to it, John, and the thing that changed, because every quarter when they meet, they update their economic forecast, which they did this time. And as they have indicated, as just a couple of weeks ago when Powell's on Capitol Hill, he's saying, I'm having more confidence about economic growth and our ability to raise rates gradually, which basically he reiterated there in saying that, hey, we're still planning on to raising interest rates 3 times. We'll get into that in a minute. What did change this time, he changed some of the wording accompanying the meeting, was basically saying, hey, in the first quarter, things weren't as robust as we thought they were. So we're seeing a little bit of a slowdown in economic growth, which has been very characteristic of what we've seen in this economic recovery. But here's what threw the markets off. Instead of raising interest rates only 2 times in 2019, they raised the dot plot by another quarter. So they plan on raising interest rates 3 times instead of 2. So they are now raising where they think the Fed funds rate is going to be by the time they get this done. It could be at 3.5%. Personally, I don't think they're going to get that far, but nonetheless, that's what they said. Right now, the futures market has a 82% probability they will raise rates again in June. There's a 52% probability that they'll raise rates for the 3rd time in September. A 50% chance that they will raise rates for the 3rd time in November. So the probability of raising rates for the 3rd time is about equal when it comes to September, or it ends up being in November. And then there's a 43% chance that the 3rd rate hike comes in December. And here's the one that's in there. The futures market is saying there's a 29% probability that they could raise rates for the 4th time in December. That assumes that they either go probably in September, I would suspect. So the futures market is right in tune with what the Fed is saying in this meeting. They are going to be continuing to raise interest rates. And if all goes as planned, by the end of the year, we will see a Fed funds rate at 2.25. What does that mean for you, an investor? Well, the yields on short-term debt is going up, whether you're looking at treasury bills or you're looking at 2-year notes. And for the first time, banks, which are lending money, are starting to raise interest rates that they give depositors. The national average for CD rates now is about 0.5%, whoopee, but at least it's, you know, better than 0.25%. So as the Fed proceeds and continues to raise, you're probably going to end up seeing the rates that you get at a bank go up slightly, but where the big movement is going to be in treasury bills, in treasury notes, especially in 3-6 month, and especially on the 2-year, 3-year notes, you're going to see them go up. So anyway, there is a possibility they may go 4 times, which is why the market is saying, well, this is a little bit too hawkish for us. And especially since they raised the amount of rate hikes they're anticipating doing in 2019. So for this year, if all goes as planned, They'll raise it three times. It's debatable whether the next one comes in September or November, but the markets are saying an 82% probability that they'll go again in June.
I know you mentioned in there changes in language affecting economic growth. Anything significantly different?
There were a few changes in the March statement. One of them was on economic activity. They changed it at a moderate rate, reflecting a weaker first quarter. It was anticipated we'd be coming in around 2.8, or some were talking about 3%. Doesn't look that way now. They removed the language that business fixed investment is moderating. So other than that, there wasn't really too much that changed in the statement. I guess the real big change was upping the amount of rate hikes coming into next year in going full steam this year with their planned 3 rate hikes. So other than that, it was more of, hey, here's why we're doing this. We think the economy is picking up. We think economic growth is going to be stronger. We think inflation is going to hit our target zone. So we feel confident enough that we could go forward and start raising interest rates. And Powell emphasized that when he was on Capitol Hill a couple of weeks ago, said that a lot of headwinds have now turned into tailwinds. And he once again repeated that when he gave his first press conference as Fed chairman on Wednesday.
Indeed, the economic outlook has strengthened in recent months. Several factors are supporting the outlook. Fiscal policy has become more stimulative. Ongoing job gains are boosting incomes and confidence. Foreign growth is on a firm trajectory, and overall financial conditions remain accommodative. The median projection for the growth of inflation-adjusted GDP is 2.7% this year, 2.4% next year, and 2% in 2020, a bit above its estimated longer-run rate.
So there you have it, the Fed talking confidently about all this fiscal stimulus. And by the way, we just got more stimulus on Friday with the president signing an extended spending bill of $1.3 trillion to take the government to the fiscal year ending in September. The one reason the Fed is saying this is the one thing the economy has going for it and why it is allowing the Fed to have more confidence is the massive stimulus. It's coming from Washington in the form of tax cuts and government spending. John, these guys are like drunken sailors. I don't care if it's Democrats or it's Republicans. Republicans are showing they're every bit as good at spending money as the Democrats are. And on Friday, the big news, you know, there was no government shutdown. They have been postponing this budget process, and we never seem to get beyond these short-term budget process extensions. This one, it will be 6 months. It'll take us all the way to the government's fiscal year, which will end in October. And they just passed, you know, an additional $1.3 trillion. Not additional, but I mean, they increased that amount. So this year, we are looking at a budget deficit for the U.S. government that is going to be in the neighborhood between $700 and $800 billion. Next year, we will hit $1 trillion for 2019. Now, what is making this significant is the economy is growing. The unemployment rate is the lowest it's been since the 1960s, and we are now running $1 trillion deficits, which raises the question, when we get into a recession and you have to re-stimulate the economy, when you have more people unemployed, when things like unemployment insurance, all the other expenses that go in when people lose their jobs, including a loss in tax revenues, what those budget deficits, we could be back to 1.5, 1.7. And some are saying at some point, depending on how bad of a recession, we could even be up to $2 trillion. Remember, they're still talking about another tax cut, and they're still talking about an infrastructure spending bill. We haven't even got to those parts yet, and we're now running for this year somewhere in the neighborhood of $700 to $800 billion. And that is going to be a lot of money. And what this means is the Treasury is now going to be coming to the market with hundreds of billions of dollars of new debt at a time. The major buyers of that debt, including the Fed, the Bank of China, and Japan, are cutting back on their treasury purchases. And we saw what this means. If you take a look at last month, when we saw bond yields really spike high, it looked like the 10-year was going to take out 3%, got over almost like 2.96, I think was the number. And one of the reasons it spiked like that is the Treasury came to the market with $250 billion of new debt. So we're likely to see more spikes is funding needs increase with this increased spending that we've embarked on. They just signed this bill that we talked about on Friday, which you'll see in the evening news. It was the big thing because the talk, quote, was there going to be another government shutdown, which government shutdowns are more drama with the media than they are anything else. But the point being is with this increase in spending, the government is going to be tapping the bond markets for more funding, which is going to put pressure on interest rates, not to mention what the Fed is doing on the short end.
You know, if you put this together, what you notice is one thing this might lead to is that the government would have to finance greater deficits, and they're doing it at a time when the Fed is raising most of the cost of financing deficits, which could lead to more deficits.
Well, you bring up a good point, because as the Fed raises interest rates, especially on the short end, where you've seen the greatest increase, you're seeing it in Treasury bills. It's hard to believe, folks. In the summer of 2016, Treasury bills offered negative interest rates, meaning if you invested in a Treasury bill, you lost money. Here we are, fast forward 2 years later, and we have Treasury bills that are approaching close to 2%. And what does that mean? Because a lot of government debt is financed short term. It means the cost of financing that $21 trillion of debt is becoming more expensive. And let me just give you an example. It may not sound like much, but it is running into tens and 20 and 30 billions more in interest expense. Right now, as of February, the government's overall interest rate on all its debt, there's two forms. There's debt that's held by the public. That's what you and I can invest in. And then there's non-marketable debt that is held in the various trust funds, IOUs like Social Security. That figure on overall government debt, on marketable debt, was 2.17%. That is up from the same time last year of nearly 2%. Non-marketable debt is 2.8%, which is close to what it was about a year ago. Total interest on all of its debt has risen to 2.347. Let's just round it off to say 2.34 compared to 2.24. Now, you may not think of on the surface that doesn't sound like much when you're talking about 0.1%, but take 0.1% and multiply it times $21 trillion, and it adds up to tens of billions of dollars of additional expense. Now, where we are now, just to give you an example, in the year 2015 and 2016, the overall average interest on government debt was 2%. So we've gone up roughly almost 0.4% in interest. When you start at such low levels and you start raising, and that was one thing that I guess the Obama administration had going forward, it doubled the national debt from 10 to 20 trillion. But during that whole 8-year period as president, the Treasury was paying out less in interest expense compared to 2008 is because interest rates got down to zero. So it made it cheaper for the government to expand and take on more debt because it cost it less. So given the fact that we are now looking at $21 trillion in debt, and now that debt is going to be growing at $1 trillion a year, and once again, we're not even in a recession now.
I'm going to put a clip in here, Jim, that I think is a predecessor to the question I'm going to ask.
You work here. Don't you want good insurance?
Don't need it. Never been sick. Perfect immune system.
Okay, well, if you've never been sick, then you don't have any antibodies.
I don't need them. Superior genes. I'm a shrewd. And superior brain power. Through concentration, I can raise and lower my cholesterol at will.
Why would you want to raise your cholesterol?
So I can lower it.
Now, having heard the clip there, given that the economy slowed in the first quarter, as reflected in the FOMC minutes, still unemployment is the lowest we've seen in almost a decade. Inflation is low. It is creeping up a little. Okay. So why are they continuing with the rate hikes? Because sooner or later, they'll tip everything into a recession and the Fed is going to have to start all over again just to lower rates. It looks like they're creating headroom for themselves is what it does.
Yeah, what they're trying to do here is reload their chamber. So they have some bullets to fire, let's say in the next downturn or recession. But the very process they're going through of reloading the chamber could very well contribute to the next recession. And that's the irony of what they're doing. And that's why some people are questioning, why do you have to keep going maybe three times? Can't you back it off a little bit? Because the economy certainly isn't overheating. We certainly don't have an inflationary problem. And even though the unemployment rate is at the lowest level since the 60s, we're not really seeing major wage inflation. Yes, it's gone up. It's what I think it's up about 2.9% year over year. But you can't go out there and say, oh my goodness, we are really seeing high inflation in the economy. For example, leading up to the last crisis when they raised interest rates, throwing us into a recession, the inflation rates were closer to 5% or more. We're nowhere near that now. We're struggling just to get up to the 2% level. So as the Fed chairman stated, what was once, John, why they're going ahead with this is they feel they can reload the chamber. It's safe enough to do it because there are a lot of things that were once headwinds are now turning into tailwinds with massive fiscal stimulus. And plus, economic growth is picked up globally. So there was a period of time, especially between 2013 and 2016, where the U.S. was the best game in town. Europe was in a recession. Japan's economy was in a recession. Now we have global synchronized economic growth. So we no longer have that as a headwind. But here's the problem. The Fed is at risk here of making a major policy mistake from two different perspectives. Number one, the economy could be less strong than what the central bank thinks. And we've seen this over the last couple of years where you'll see the economy pick up in the second and third quarter. It weakens in the fourth quarter and the first quarter as it's doing now. The other thing is it doesn't take much and we'll get into this. It's not just interest rates that sends you into recession. There are a combination of factors related to those interest rates. So we've seen some mixed signals on retail spending. We've seen it in autos. We've seen a pullback in housing. Number two, another mistake they could be making is the economy is strong, but it's creating jobs with less inflation. A lot of that is due to the automation that you're seeing take place as robots enter into the workforce, and also what they call the Amazon effect that's hitting the retail sector. So, you know, the economy has changed from the industrial economy that we used to think about in our economic textbooks in the 50s and 60s. It's more of a tech-driven and a service-driven economy. And I'm not sure the Fed is using the right tools to measure it in terms of which to gauge its policy responses. So as we take a look at where we are now, certainly the economy isn't overheating. Inflation is rising, but it's nowhere near becoming a major problem. And you do have signs that are mixed coming from, as I mentioned, retail sales, housing, and of course, auto sales, we believe, have peaked. And on the international front, we're also starting to see the synchronized global economy is showing some signs of strain. Economic data has been coming in well below forecast. If we take a look at the last couple of months in the Eurozone, industrial production and inflation have also been below expectations. But the U.S. side, there is lots of stimulus coming with trillion-dollar deficits, which we just passed a large spending bill, so we're even adding more spending to the spending they were talking about before. So all of this is going to juice the economy, and that's why I think the Fed is saying, with all the stimulus, you know what? We got a protective hedge around us so we could go ahead and keep hiking rates. So when we do crash the economy, well, we can cut rates again.
So given what the Fed is doing, is there any recession risk at the moment, or do they have some room here?
You know, the problem, I guess, is the one the markets are assessing, and some people are saying, are they pushing this too far? Now, one of the issues has to deal with the Fed's own thinking itself. They feel the natural rate of unemployment is around 4.5%. Currently, it's at 4.1, and on its current trajectory, it is estimated by next year it could be down to 3.6 at the rate that we're adding jobs. So the Fed's thinking this is way too low and is a potential inflationary problem. This deals with the Fed's belief in the Phillips curve, which really hasn't been working. And that is the lower the unemployment rate goes, the higher the inflation rate. Well, we're down to 4.1, the best unemployment rate we've seen since the 60s, and inflation hasn't met the Fed's target yet. So if you look at what the Fed is trying to do in the next few years, it's trying to do something it's never accomplished before, and that is guide the unemployment rate up, meaning basically put more people out of work and raise the unemployment rate to around a comfortable level of 4.5%. The previous attempts They've tried to do this in the past. If you take a look at World War II, 11 out of 12 times, it led to a recession. So they don't have a very good track record of being able to do this. So what they really need to be careful of is not just a rise in interest rates. And I don't want to imply just because they raise interest rates, that's going to lead to recession. It's the other things that accompany the rise in interest rates that creates the problem. And here's where the problem comes. The rise in interest rates eventually leads to a bear market in the stock market, and this time the bond market, in asset prices collapse. What happens when that happens? Investors lose confidence. Consumers lose confidence. Even though you may not have a lot of money invested in the market, everybody knows or gets a little bit more fearful or hesitant when they hear the Dow is crashing or the markets are coming down. And when people begin to lose confidence, what do? They pull back. They become more cautious. They become more risk adverse. They pull back on their spending. They increase their savings. And an illustration of this is both the 2001 and the 2007-2009 recessions were driven more by collapsing asset prices than they were by higher interest rates. The S&P 500 lost over 50% in the 2001 recession and downturn and bear market, and the S&P lost 58% in the last recession and bear market between 2007 and 2009. If you see your assets fall by 60%, as they did in the last downturn, or if you're a homeowner and you see the price of your home drop by over 40%, what are you going to do? You're going to sit there and you're going to say, it frightens you. Is your job secure? Is your business secure? You start pulling back. So it's not, John, just the rise in interest rates that's the problem. Because if you take a look at human beings, the emotion of fear is much more powerful than the emotion of greed, and markets can fall faster than they can rise, and the unemployment rate can rise faster than it falls. And a good example is bull markets tend to be escalator rides. Bear markets are elevator rides. And we saw a bit of that coming out of late January into February when we lost 12% in 6 days. And that's the way these things tend to go. And if they last long enough, and here's where the Fed has to be careful, I believe right now, we'll get into this as we conclude this module, is that we are in a transitionary period into the what I call the final phase of the business cycle in the market cycle. And as we do that, you're going to see more volatility, as you're seeing now. You're going to see a change in leadership, which I believe is coming. So you're going to see much of this, but the Fed has to be real careful, because when the pullback or the swift correction that we saw in January and February, they said, that's not a problem. We're not worried about that. And the markets were a little taken back, like, okay, the Fed, this doesn't disturb it. You watch, if this continues and lasts longer, watch what happens to consumer confidence, which will get reflected in retail sales, which will get reflected in business spending. So one aspect of this recent correction in the Fed comments is, what the heck, no big deal. So we are at risk of a recession and a bear market, despite the stimulus, as the Fed said it was proceeding further with hikes and raising the number of hikes next year. The risk is of an overkill, and that was something that was questioned at the FOMC meeting.
Participants' projections of the appropriate path for the federal funds rate reflect our gradual approach. The median projection for the federal funds rate is 2.1% at the end of this year, 2.9% at the end of 2019, and 3.4% at the end of 2020. By 2020, the median federal funds rate is modestly above its estimated longer-run trend.
Where's your biggest concern here? Is it in overkill when it comes to rates or underkill?
So you're right that the outlook did improve. As I mentioned, and as was in your question, the committee's estimates of growth went up, the committee's estimates of unemployment went down, and there was a very slight increase in inflation. And I think that reflects essentially, if you think back to the era after the crisis, unemployment was 10%. It's now 4.1%. You've only seen very gradual upward pressures on inflation and wages despite that very large increase. And that suggests that the relationship between changes in slack and inflation is not so tight. But it has diminished, but it's still there. So I think when you see those small changes in unemployment, that simply reflects the flatness of the Phillips curve, if you will.
So there you have the Fed chairman himself saying they have no indication they intend to slow down. And we know, and at this point, we don't know, is the one thing we know, eventually they keep doing this, we will be in a recession and we will be in a bear market. And it'll probably be the bear market and assets that triggers the recession along with interest rates. What we don't know is when is a rate hike too far. We don't know right now. If you listen to what the Fed is saying, they intend to take the Fed funds rate closer to about 3.5%. I personally don't think they're going to get that far, meaning that they would raise rates three times this year, three times in 2019, and two times in 2020. I just don't think you can keep doing this consistently without sooner or later, this is going to catch up with the stock market assets, making it more expensive to finance and get credit, whether you're buying a home and need to get a mortgage with mortgage rates now climbing to 4.5%. Credit card interest is going up. And then also it's more expensive to finance a car. So right now, as the Fed has indicated, there are tailwinds coming from fiscal stimulus with the tax cuts and major increases in government spending. So if you want to take a look at this, I liken this to if you want to take a look at a football game, with 2018 being the third quarter of a football game and 2019 being the fourth quarter, because I just don't think they're going to be able to get away raising three times this year, three times next year, and two times in 2020 before a recession happens or we get a serious bear market and stocks. But right now, the one thing that we have going for the economy is there is a hell of a lot of stimulus being applied right now, which reduces the risk of recession.
What do you suppose could, what would we say, destabilize this equation? I mean, remember before they threw things off and then we had Lehman Brothers and all sorts of other things went wrong. So what could throw us off the trail again?
Another financial mishap, as I mentioned, it's not just the rise in interest rates that leads us into a bear market and recession. It's also the collapse of asset prices and also the loss of confidence, both by business and consumers. And the one thing the Fed needs to be very cognizant of now, there is an awful lot of leverage in the financial system now. And it's not inconceivable that sooner or later, something could happen that could shock the system. Now, we had shocks in 2011. Remember Fukushima, the Arab Spring, downgrading of U.S. debt, the pig crisis in Europe. We had it again in 2013 with the taper tantrum, again in 2015 with China slowdown. But as long as the economy is growing, you can better absorb these shocks. And that's what we did. The markets were disruptive. We had corrections. In fact, almost a 20% correction in 2011, but we bounced back. So right now we've been fortunate. So as long as you have strong economic growth, you can absorb these little what I call black swans or rogue waves that occasionally hit the market.
Let's jump to the LEIs, which we did cover last week. The bulk of them are all pointing up. So if there are other risks that might be lurking out there, how will we recognize that? How will we know when we're getting there?
You know, one thing that we did, we have our own LEI index that we track both here and international. And then we also have our own proprietary recession index. But one thing that we did, and my son Chris developed this about 6 months ago, is we wanted to answer the same kind of question ourselves. When is a rate hike too far? And in order to do that, we came up with a monetary model that tracks, is the Fed still tight? Is it tightening? Is it too tight? Is it too loose? To kind of gauge when are we starting to enter into that danger zone where a one or two more hikes may be a hike too far. Now, the monetary model analyzes the risk of Fed policy in terms of, once again, are they tight, just right, or are they loose? And whenever our model goes above zero, it's an indicator that policy is tight and tightening. And we saw that happen in 1999, and eventually we had a recession. We saw that tighten again in 2007. Right now, our model is a negative 3%. showing that policy is still loose. So even though they have been raising rates and we are further away from zero. Now, there was one time that we got in the last couple of years, we got up to that zero point, but we quickly fell back. And if you think back to some of the things that were going on back in 2015, we were worried about a Chinese slowdown. 2013, it was the taper tantrum. In 2011, it was the downgrading of debt and the pig crisis. But then the model came right back down. And what did the Fed do? In 2011, it followed up with QE3. So the Fed injected more monetary stimulus into the economy, just as the federal government now is injecting more fiscal stimulus. So right now, if you look at the recent hikes this week, the Chicago Fed's National Financial Conditions Index, which comes out weekly, is sort of a snapshot of U.S. financial conditions. It measures everything from the yield curve to the dollar index. And this week, it came in at 0.78, suggesting its financial conditions are looser than average. So it pretty much lines up with our own monetary indicator. The other thing to keep in mind, even though the Fed envisions 6 rate hikes over the next 2 years, 3 this year, 3 coming next year, that compares to only 60 basis points that's being priced into the market by traders in the futures market. And if you take a look at short-dated futures between the years 2018 and 2020. So if you look at what the Fed's doing, it is saying it's going to go in this direction. But the futures market says, nope, I don't think you're going to get that far, which is our own belief, because there's just too much leverage out there. The stock market is certainly not cheap today. And in fact, when you take a look at what indexing has done to distort the valuations of companies from Facebook to many of these tech companies, which are sporting like Amazon, PE ratios that are almost unthinkable. But it happens automatically with mindless investing as this money goes into index funds. So the disparity between what the Fed thinks and what the market thinks, this translates into greater market volatility, because when the market perceives one thing, then all of a sudden the Fed throws a curveball and says, nope, that's what you guys are thinking, but here's what we're now thinking. That always creates the chance for a financial mishap somewhere, just as we saw, for example, at the end of January, when you had the unwinding of the shorting of the volatility trade, when volatility levels got down to below 10, and they thought they were going to remain that way. Well, we saw that unwind in January, and the results were a 12% correction in the market. So our recession index, by the way, is currently at 11. It's when it gets to 20 that we begin to worry. And there were a couple times in 2011, 15, and 16 when it bumped up against 20, but quickly faded and came back. And we saw responses. We saw QE responses in 2011. That was followed by QE3. In 2015, we saw the Fed back off from 3 rate hikes to only 1. Only 1 hike at the end of the year. In 2016, we saw the Fed do the same thing. They backed off and only raised interest rates 1 time. So, you know, right now, why the Fed is going ahead and feels safe to do so is there's just an awful lot of stimulus that's being applied. So the risk of recession is very low right now. But what you are going to see this year, and you're seeing it already, volatility is going to increase as we transition to this final phase of the bull market and also the economic recovery.
Well, I know you've been making allocations in both the bond and stock portfolios for your clients. What should investors be doing right now?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. You better have an exit plan, because you better have a plan B. Especially if you're invested in index funds, you're not really monitoring this market, because at some point, this is going to start to turn. Not now. Right now, we're going through a period of volatility as we transition to this final phase. But, I mean, we're using short-term bonds. We're only using special kind of munis in our bond portfolio that where we could track the interest rate coverage, because a lot of these states, there's over 15 of them that are going to be in financial trouble in the next recession, according to Moody's. And then we're also using interest rate floaters to protect against that. And then finally, when it comes to the stock market, we are transitioned or have made that transition to the kind of stocks that would do well in this final phase of the market. So, you know, changes are afoot. We are transitioning to this final phase, and the Fed, you know, we know what happens historically when they do this. When you have 11 out of the last 12 recessions preceded by something that happened with a Fed rate raising cycle, you know you're headed for trouble eventually.
interest rates are rising, and the Fed intends to raise interest rates even further. As rates rise, the value of your bond funds will fall. Are you prepared for the next bond bear market? It has been almost 36 years since we've seen the last, and there's a high probability that another bear market in bonds has just begun. Long-term interest rates have been rising steadily since last fall. It's time to think about protecting capital. That's where Financial Sense Advisors can help you. Protect capital by designing a customized portfolio that can provide you with predictable income. Don't put your hard-earned wealth at risk. Call us today.
So give us a call at Financial Sense Advisors. As investment fiduciaries, we put your interest first. Let us help you design a portfolio that provides predictable income and protects your capital. Call now, toll free, 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939 to let us help you design a portfolio providing predictable income and protecting your capital. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense NewsHour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
If you're a resident of San Francisco and you're having problems getting streets paved, just the basics, now the taxes are going up and there's less tax revenue to spend, are you going to support that initiative that says, I'm going to take millions of dollars and put it over here? Probably not. But guess what? The people who are proponents of that tend to be in the Democrat Party. So in essence, this whole state and local tax puts enormous pressure on the local politicians. And in major metro areas, those local politicians tend to be Democrats. So what Trump has done is he's really turned the screws on the Democratic Party at the local urban level, the metro areas, because he's basically taken money out of their pockets, and the only way they can recover is either to cut programs or raise taxes. And neither of these are going to be very popular.
Welcome back to the Financial Sense NewsHour, the big picture. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. Well, this week, the media found something new, some new angst about which they could wring their hands for 24 hours a day. They're the only ones who have succeeded in taking a 10-minute newscast and turning it into a 24-hour event. And the question is President Trump getting us into a trade war, which might resemble what happened back in the 1930s with the introduction of Smoot-Hawley tariffs, which actually prolonged the Great Depression? Could this actually lead us into another global economic catastrophe? Dun, dun, dun. That's what all the conversation was about this week. So what's the reality of this whole thing anyway, Jim?
You know, the problem I have with the media today is, you know, you can't blame them. They want to get ratings. Is every little thing is blown up to 24-hour coverage. And the problem I have with it is they're too prone to what I call hyperbole. I mean, the tax cuts were going to create Armageddon. Getting tough with North Korea was going to lead us to nuclear war. And now trade tariffs are going to lead us into a recession. And some are saying even a Great Depression, citing, as you did, John, the Smoot-Hawley tariffs of the 1930s. And what this really needs to do is be put into perspective, folks. I mean, global GDP right now is north of $75 trillion, $50 to $60 billion of trade tariffs on steel and aluminum is not going to sink the economy or the global economy for that matter. I mean, it is unfortunate, but the three previous presidents have negotiated very poor trade agreements that put the U.S. at a disadvantage in trade. And we've seen this play out over the last three or four decades, where the industrial base of the U.S. has shrunk from around 25% of GDP after World War II to today, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of between 10 and 12%. In a large swath of many areas of the country, we refer to it as the Rust Belt, were places where major factories, whether it was steel manufacturing, were closed down. Those factories were moved overseas along with the jobs, along with the increase in globalization. And a lot of our trade partners, and especially China, do not play fair when it comes to trade. So if you look at what Trump is trying to do here, he's very big on revitalizing manufacturing back in the U.S., which is important to keeping a strong economy. You have to make stuff. You can't buy all your stuff from everybody else. So what has happened over the last three decades? We've seen increased regulation. Up until recently, the U.S. had the highest corporate tax rates in the world. And so if you're a multinational corporation, it favored moving production overseas and keeping your profits overseas. And so along with that, factories were closed here, they were moved overseas, and everything was outsourced, giving rise to what we call today known as platform companies. And Apple's a good example. The engineering and marketing is done here in the U.S., but the bulk of its manufacturing is done overseas, and a lot of its profits are kept overseas. We had $2 trillion of untaxed profits, some are saying it's even larger than that, that were kept overseas because our tax rates of 35% prior to this tax cut were the highest in the world. What happened? The president cut tax rates to 21%, so we are now competitive with the developed countries in the world with the average tax rate at 22. So we are now in line. What did that do? You've seen companies like Apple is bringing back $250 billion of untaxed profits, of which they'll pay close to $40 billion in taxes. And you've also seen not only the tax rates come down, the regulations come down. So we're trying to unwind and make the U.S. a better place for investment, a better place for manufacturing. He wants to revitalize part of our manufacturing base because he said you can't have a very, very strong economy if you don't have a manufacturing base, which I couldn't agree more. You see it in Germany in terms of the strength of the German economy. In countries that let their manufacturing go away, then what you're doing is you're importing. And remember, when we import as much as we do, our trade deficit this year will be $600 billion. That reduces U.S. economic growth because it's subtracted. That means the stuff you buy in stores is money you are sending to overseas manufacturers. Now, many of it, sometimes indirectly, is U.S. companies that make stuff over there, ship it over here. But nonetheless, it reduces U.S. GDP, also U.S. manufacturing base. So this is something he's trying to change. And you can't keep running $600-700 billion trade deficits with the rest of the world and having foreigners own the majority of your debt. That is unsound financially. And we've seen that happen from countries like Argentina and others that can eventually get themselves in trouble if you allow that to happen.
And it would seem too, Jim, that one of the real issues lying underneath all of this is that China is our major trade partner and a major part of the deficit lies right there.
Yeah, and it's been proven. Many U.S. companies complain about it. One of the things that Beijing does is it improperly forces U.S. firms that do business with Chinese companies is they must transfer their technology to the Chinese company. It's a requirement to do business there. They also steal intellectual property and they subsidize their industry and they apply tariffs. So basically what Trump is saying, look, you put a 25% tariff on something, we're going to put a 25% tariff. If you have a 25% tariff and you reduce it down to 0 or 5% or whatever it is, we will reduce our tariff down. But we're going to level this trading field, and he wants to make it more advantageous for U.S. companies to set up shop here, to manufacture, bring jobs back here to the country. But he also wants to whittle away that trade deficit because no country can run perpetual trade deficits eventually without finding itself in trouble with its own currency. That's ever more important because the U.S. dollar is the world's trade currency. Despite what everybody tells you, the vast majority of trade globally is still done in U.S. dollars. So the administration is basically getting tough, starting out with this $30 billion and steel and aluminum tariffs. And John, it may be even more, but it's going to be a negotiating tactic. And I think eventually this is going to lead to some kind of settlement with China that is going to make it more favorable, the terms more favorable, and undo some of these unfavorable terms that have been in so many of our trade agreements negotiated by previous presidents.
So if the market seems to be enmeshed in fears, what are they worried about?
There's two main concerns. Number one is the U.S. could end its NAFTA trade agreement, which is especially affect countries like Canada and Mexico. And secondly, there's a section in our laws, it's called Section 301, that allows it to investigate countries' treatment of, for example, intellectual property rights. And it would allow the U.S. to take unilateral action against an unfair trade practice being levied against the U.S. or U.S. companies by another country. And number three, trade tariffs could give way to higher inflation, meaning that if it dries up the cost of goods or imports or things like that, it could lead to higher inflation. Higher inflation could lead to more Fed interest rates. But, you know, as my friend Dr. Gary Schilling talks about, this is one game where the U.S. has an advantage. Number one, we are the buyer of last resort. And when you are the buying customer of a nation and you are its largest customer, you have a lot of sway with them. The other thing is that you take a look at the U.S. economy. We are more self-reliant when it comes to making things, when it comes to our own natural resources compared to other countries. That China now has, for example, surpassed the U.S. in having to import more oil than we do because we're producing more. In fact, we're going to surpass Saudi Arabia this year to become the second largest producer of oil in the world. So we're less dependent on trade in comparison to a country like China. So if you take a look at what the administration is basically doing here, is they're looking for reciprocity in trade. The U.S. would pose restrictions on Chinese investments similar to those that they impose on U.S. firms doing business in China. And some are saying, well, the U.S. Doesn't have the same heft it used to, because at one time after World War II, we made up 40% of global GDP. Today, that number is closer to 25%. It, you know, even though it's only 25% of world GDP, that is still a staggering number. So if you take a look at global GDP of somewhere around 75 trillion, you know, we're almost 19, 20 trillion of that. So we can inflict a lot of pain on the Chinese economy because the U.S. also has many allies similar in Europe and Japan who are feeling some of the unfairness of what China is trying to do to the detriment of its trading partners. As Dr. Schilling recently pointed out in a recent newsletter, is the U.S. has the upper hand. And John, I think this is more of the media making this into a much bigger issue than what it really is. So if you think about it, a $75 trillion global economy, and we're talking about $30 to $50 billion in tariffs, is like a gnat on an elephant, so this too shall pass. And there was an interview with billionaire investor Ken Fisher on Friday, and he reflected our own thoughts as well.
There is something that's simply important, which is that to move from a world that we've been in to a world that fears what we're doing, which is that tariffs cause recession and you know the rest of the narrative. They miss a simple point, which is that to tip economic growth at 3% into recession, you got to come up with $3 trillion of new global negative GDP. A couple of billion here and there, it's like throwing pebbles into a lake. People miss the insignificance of the relative scale. People aren't good at scaling. They're missing the point that these tariffs, which are bad, they're wrong, it's a mistake,
right,
aren't big enough to do enough to cause the thing that people are extrapolating.
So once again, there, you know, Ken is putting it into perspective. He's saying that, you know, when you take a look at 3% economic growth globally, you know, you're talking about $30 to $40, $50 billion of tariffs, and the media would have you believe this is going to lead to a recession or even worse, is just once again hyperbole on part of the media. And so this too, John, will pass. This will be resolved in one way or another with a better trade agreement, and it will correct some of these imbalances that we've seen in our trade agreements that we've seen take place by various American presidents over the last two or three decades. So this, once again, will pass. This is not Smoot-Hawley. This is not the 1930s, and we're not going to head into a recession because of this, just as the tax cuts aren't going to lead to Armageddon.
And maybe as we round out the show, the most important lesson we can pull out of a lot of this is if you watch how the cable news functions, they take it, like I said, a 10 or 15 minute newscast, turn it into a 24-hour event. Doesn't make any difference what it is. It just gets hammered and hammered and hammered. Okay, that's one thing. What really bothers me for the most part is they've been proven successively wrong over and over and over again, but they never go back and correct and admit that and say, well, we were wrong there. Now we're going to try to make it better here. And maybe that tells us about the quality of their news reporting at the same time. All right, that's it for this week. Jim, what are we looking for in weeks to come here on the Financial Sense News Hour?
Well, what do we got coming? The third quarter is going to end here in the next week or so, and we'll be looking at Q1 earnings reports. They were very robust for the fourth quarter, and not too many revisions for first quarter, so we expect robust earnings to be the result of the first quarter, so the market will be focusing on that, and it'll give it something. But I'm sure, John, just as we're worried about trade right now, there's probably something else out there that we're not thinking about that will be another worry du jour for the market. But right now, the economy is growing, earnings are growing, money is being put to work in the economy, and right now, all of that is a positive. So we'll be here to talk about it in the weeks ahead, but the next big event on the agenda will be corporate earnings. That's coming up here in just about 2 or 3 weeks. And then, of course, the markets will be bracing for the next Fed rate hike, which is anticipated to come to June, when they will raise the Fed's funds rate to 2%. The other thing, too, is we will be getting the first quarter economic numbers that they'll start to flood probably the second or third week in April. So we can take a look at, as the Fed just mentioned in its FOMC meeting minutes accompanying that meeting, they're saying, hey, yeah, things slowed down a little bit. They weren't as robust in the first quarter. That should be reflected in some of the economic numbers we'll be reporting on next month. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.